And the second case is 2022-0055 in the matter of the application of Firelands Wind for certificate of environmental compatibility and public need to construct a wind-powered electric generating facility. For the appellants, Mr. Van Clay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Firelands has chosen to site its wind turbine facility in a uniquely bad location in a migratory pathway towards one of the most significant bird sanctuaries in the world, in an area full of bald eagles that will be killed by the turbines, and an area in which sensitive karst formations that provide drinking water for the wells utilized by the area's residents will be threatened by the use of grouting in the turbine foundations. I'd like to start my first legal point by discussing briefly how this case compares to this court's plurality decision in Buckeye Wind. Just to make one point about that, which is that even though the application of Buckeye Wind was briefed by the parties, that issue concerning whether or not the board is allowed to include post-certificate conditions in its certificate after the certificate has been issued really only applies to two of the propositions of law in this case, which are Proposition 4, dealing with shadow flicker, and Proposition 7, dealing with bald eagles. Now, the distinction between Buckeye Wind in this case for those two propositions of law is that in this case, the failure to do the homework, the failure to do the studies necessary to determine whether the facility would comply with the shadow flicker requirements and would protect bald eagles was required by rule, which was not a situation in Buckeye that was presented in Buckeye Wind. Here we have rules that have been adopted by the board for the purpose of assisting the board to determine whether the criteria in revised code 4906.10A have been met. The compliance with those rules is critical to determine whether the board can find that those criteria have been met. In this particular case, we would submit that they have not been. But as I mentioned, Buckeye Wind and how it's applied really is relevant only to those two propositions of law. There are many other propositions of law. In fact, most of our propositions of law also involve violations of the rules that are supposed to be followed and implemented by the board in order to determine whether the criteria in 4906.10 have been met. One of those propositions of law which deal with well protection is a proposition of law that discusses the distinction between the geotechnical surveys that are supposed to be done to determine whether a turbine will basically fall over, that it will collapse if the soil is not adequate, versus hydrogeologic surveys, studies that are done by groundwater experts to determine whether putting the foundations of those turbines in will block people's water supplies. In a karst area, the water flows through the openings underground in the limestone. Some people refer to those as underground rivers, but they can be much smaller than that. And all of the area's residents depend on that groundwater for their water supply. They have no other means to obtain water. So this is an extremely critical issue here. In this particular case, Firelands did the geotechnical studies, but they didn't do any groundwater studies that would indicate whether filling karst openings with grouting will block the flow to people's wells. Now, they pretend that they did. There are some very generic statements in the application which say that they've looked at the sources of groundwater in the area, but those studies didn't go as far as actually evaluating whether grouting openings would fill in the channels that are necessary to supply people's water supply. So that is a study that is required by rule. The rule specifically says that the applicant must provide an evaluation of the impact to public and private water supplies due to construction of the turbine facility.
So the grouting issue, I'm over here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The grouting issue, it requires prior board approval under the certificate. Are you lacking confidence in the board that it would allow grouting to proceed that would block residents' access to their groundwater?
Yeah, what the board did in its certificate was to assign that responsibility to the staff after the certificate is issued. And this is in paragraph 85 of the board's decision. And there's no guidance to the staff as to what criteria they're supposed to use in determining whether grouting can take effect.
Do the rules cover it?
The rules do not, no. The rules simply say you have to provide groundwater studies in order to determine the effect of the turbines on people's water supplies. But it does not specifically say anything about grouting and whether grouting is to be used or whether it can't be used. So that is unlike the situations where we have in other cases that have been decided by this court, where the certificate assigns the staff with essentially ministerial duties to deal with the minutia, the basic ministerial issues. Buckeye Wind refers to it as determining the color of the screws in the control room, as an extreme example of a type of duty that the staff can be entrusted to do because it has no bearing on whether the criteria in 4906.10 have been met. And so that's a very important distinction here, because here we have the necessity for the board to determine whether it can allow the applicant to fill the karst openings with grout, and it just assigns that responsibility to the staff with no guidance whatsoever as to what criteria the staff is going to use.
Well, would it be better if it assigned it to an outside engineering firm?
Well, certainly it would be better, but that's not really what the certificate provides. What the board should have done was to require the applicant to have such a study done by an engineering firm, actually a hydrogeologic firm, is what they should have done. They should have had the applicant submit a hydrogeology study on individual turbine locations to determine whether grouting in those areas should be allowed or whether the grouting would block people's water supply. So that is the type of study that needs to be done prior to the certification, because it has a bearing on whether that wind farm is going to meet the minimum adverse environmental requirement under 4906.10A3.
This is on about 80 acres, is that right?
It is, this covers
Three counties.
32,000 acres, I think.
Okay, so it's eight.
But of course, the turbines are spread out throughout that area. So, but you wouldn't study the entire project area. You would just study the individual turbine sites that have been done. And it could, you know, it could be a lot lower acreage.
Mr. Van Cleve, what about the challenge to the bird migration?
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of the struggles I had with this is our level of review, our evaluation, is, you know, looks at the reasonableness of the decisions that were made in light of the evidence presented and whether they were reasonable and whether, and so one of the problems with the migrating birds of the wildlife that's usually damaged or killed by these wind turbines, if there is evidence that's conflicting, how can we choose, with all of this actually, how can we decide which evidence should have been considered more credible or more weighty, if you will, mm-hmm. than others, that, such that we can when overturn the decision?
Yes, Your Honor. We would submit that on the one critical issue we raised in our appeal, there is no conflict of evidence. Both our expert and the applicant's expert agreed that birds fly at night when they're migrating, not during the daytime. They also agreed that the habitat in the project area was lacking for those birds so that they would not land during the daytime. You would not see them there during the daytime. They also agreed that radar monitoring, that is radar surveys at night, will show whether those birds are migrating through that area on their way to Lake Erie, and whether they are low enough so that the rotors, the blades on the turbines will strike them.
But didn't ODNR map out that site and there was a determination made that where the turbines would be set was not in that migration path?
No, Your Honor, they did not.
Okay.
ODNR was consulted by the applicant. However, one thing that's clear in consultation, and we cited in our brief from a statement by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is that recommendations by the wildlife agencies are just recommendations as starting points. And it's really the applicant's responsibility to provide enough evidence to show that the wind turbines will not harm the birds. In this particular case, no radar studies were required, either before certification or after certification, despite the fact that this migratory pathway is in the way that the birds have to go in order to meet this very important bird sanctuary at McGee Marsh. And so it's critical for the board to know whether these turbines are going to slaughter unnecessarily high amounts of those migratory birds as they're traveling towards Lake Erie. Your Honor, I see I have 1:47 left. I'd like to reserve the rest of that time if I could.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Mr. Margard and Mr. Seacrest. So I understand you're going to yield 3 minutes of your time to Mr. Seacrest.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You're the timekeeper.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court, good morning. I'd first like to address the comments that were made with respect to the plurality decision in Buckeye. As this court is well aware, subsequent to the briefing in this case, this court approved the Icebreaker case. And the Icebreaker case, of course, fully endorsed the Buckeye rationale. That rationale recognized that the General Assembly has permitted the board to delegate certain responsibilities to its staff post-certificate. So the issue that was raised primarily on argument by Mr. Van Clay related to karst formations. It's important to recognize that the applicant was well aware that this area contained karst. The applicant conducted significant studies, did a desk survey of all of the available geotechnical and hydrogeological studies that were published by a variety of federal, state, and local agencies and entities. It also conducted field studies, did borings at each of the turbine sites to determine exactly what the nature of the ground was in those areas. So they were well aware of what the conditions were. That information, combined with the evidence at the hearing, 9 days of hearing, was sufficient to allow the board to determine what that potential impact would be. The board therefore reasonably determined the turbines could not be built in areas where the risk of karst formations was moderate to highly likely to occur. So it disallowed a number of turbines in those areas. What the board also reasonably determined was that it was permissible to build turbines in areas where there was a very low likelihood of karst formation, provided that there was additional further study done by an engineering firm to further evaluate what the conditions were. And that could involve, for example, electronic imaging, void assessments, a variety of things beyond mere boring. That was a reasonable determination in this case. And what the board said is that if you were to encounter karst in those situations, the applicant could determine not to build the turbine at all. They could determine to do a variety of mediation kind of efforts, including grouting. So the board approved building turbines in areas where there was a low probability of karst and approved the use of grouting, acknowledging that it disapproved widespread use of grouting.
Quick question. Does the staff of the power siting board consist of people who are trained in these technical areas?
We have a geologist on staff, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And we have extensive experience in dealing with karst formations in a variety of different siting situations. Board has sited different kind of facilities in karst formations in the past. The board and its staff are well acquainted with karst and what its effects are and how to deal with karst. So what the report to be filed is a further study, a detailed study of what those formations are and a plan for how to address those. And as I indicated, that plan may be that the turbine isn't built. There's no indication in this record that any turbine would ever be built where there was karst present. So requiring, at the time of the application, to require even post-certificate, a hydrogeological survey of all of the potential sites, when turbines may not even be built in those sites, is unnecessary. What the staff will do is to review the information that's provided by the applicant, by the operator, to determine if they are complying with the board's order. And the board's order said, you may build if the probability is low, and you may use grouting if it's necessary. That's all the board is being asked to do, all the staff is being asked to do. With respect to the migrating birds.
But going back to the grouting, the way that I understood that the certificate was that, bottom line, Firelands can't do any grouting without the prior approval of the board, and in this case, the board delegates that approval to staff. Do I have that correct?
Correct to the extent of the specific grouting that would be done, what the plans were for the grouting. But the use of grouting in building a turbine in an area of low karst probability has been pre-approved by the board. The board said that grouting could be used. Yes.
Oh, in those particular areas where it's already approved?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
With respect to the migrating birds, it's important to recognize that the applicant has done numerous studies, 29 studies over 10 years, to study the different effects that this might have on avian wildlife.
In the evening? Were any of the studies done at evening?
It did not, but as Your Honor recognized, this was done in conjunction with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Those agencies determined what level of surveying was necessary to be able to properly evaluate the impacts in that area.
But aren't the particular birds that are at risk here birds that migrate in the evening?
That's what's being claimed here, yes, and we don't deny that those birds do in fact migrate in the evening. But the different surveying areas that have been determined as to what type of surveys are required, and it's interesting to note that the applicant actually had initially proposed to do nighttime radar surveying in this area. And in consultation with ODNR and with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they indicated that not only was the geography, the topography, inappropriate for nighttime surveying, but that it was, well, as Mr. Van Clay indicated, the birds don't land. There's no stopover there. They have a tendency to just fly over. And it's the stopover characteristic of the geography that determines whether a more intensive surveying is necessary. I think, in addition, it's important to recognize U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been studying the use of nighttime radar surveying and has determined that there is not much of a correlation between radar surveys and post-construction mortalities of birds.
Are the birds more likely to be damaged when they're trying to land or when they're flying through?
Well, obviously, when they're trying to land, they have a much more likelihood of coming down through the rotor swept. So there is a greater likelihood as they're descending or ascending that they're likely to be struck by a turbine blade.
So flying through or across less, correct?
Correct.
Thanks.
That's correct. And there is not a finding here that this is a concentrated migratory pathway. Yes, the marsh is nearby. It's 30 miles to the northwest, but it's not in a migratory pathway per se. So I think it's important to recognize that a significant number of studies have been done. They were all consistent with ODNR and Fish and Wildlife Service protocols, indeed exceeded those protocols. They met with those agencies prior to conducting those surveys, consulted with them throughout, shared all of the results at the conclusion, and ODNR and Fish and Wildlife Service determined that there was no need for further study. The board in this situation had enough evidence, had sufficient evidence to be able to approve this application subject to the conditions. Its decision was lawful and reasonable, and I urge you to affirm.
Can you address the groundwater issue? I mean, the reg says that they have to provide an evaluation of the impact of public and private water supplies. Wasn't really any kind of, there was a geological kind of study, but there was no real groundwater study done here.
There is a groundwater study that's provided. It is not a detailed groundwater study. And it's possible that a groundwater study, a more detailed study, might be appropriate in some circumstances. But in this instance, it was deemed not necessary. Most of this is on shale formation bedrock. There aren't very many wells in shale formations, so there's not a need to do a detailed study there. With respect to the karstic areas, with respect to the limestone areas, what was determined is that if there's a low likelihood of karst formation, that means that there's sufficient overburden. The overburden is what lies on top of the bedrock. There's sufficient overburden there to adequately protect the groundwater supply. And that's in the record. It indicates that as long as there is roughly 30 feet of overburden, and that's soil, topsoil, rocks, gravel, so forth, that the water supplies are sufficient. It doesn't affect wells. Most of the wells don't go down into the bedrock. There's nothing further. I'll defer the remainder of my time to Mr. Sechrist.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Sechrist.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please the court. The typical wind project that comes before the Ohio Power Siting Board has approximately 200 to 400 hours of ecological surveys. This project had over 2,300 hours of ecological surveys. Firelands conducted more surveys than ODNR recommended. In terms of assessing risk to eagles, the board noted there were 4 eagle use surveys, 8 raptor nest surveys, and 3 raptor migration surveys done. This project was extensively reviewed in consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service and ODNR. The board had sufficient probative evidence in front of it to determine the probable environmental impact of this project and to determine that this project represents the minimum adverse environmental impact, particularly with respect to eagles and migrating birds. With regard to eagles, despite the low-risk nature of this project, the board is mandating Condition 31. This requires Firelands to apply for an eagle take permit prior to operation and to develop an eagle conservation plan prior to construction. Correspondence with Fish and Wildlife Service related to both these plans are required to be filed on the docket, ensuring transparency. Even in the absence of an Eagle Take permit, this project is subject to the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act and Fish and Wildlife Service's enforcement of that act. In Mr. Van Clay's...
But what does being subject to the act mean?
Being subject to the act means that Fish and Wildlife Service can institute an enforcement action, which includes criminal penalties, includes fines, and curtailment of operations.
But that doesn't, and while that might be influential in doing things the right way, if it has a significant impact to wildlife, bald eagles, migrating birds, you're hitting the pocket, but that doesn't rescue those birds. It doesn't save the environmental, it doesn't stop the environmental impact, making it more severe than maybe what the studies might indicate.
It would actually potentially stop future impacts. However, the expected impacts to eagles is minimal. As your justice has noted, and Justice Stewart probably noted in the briefing, there's a 2.5 number that was argued by appellants in terms of their proposition that 2.5 eagles per year are going to be killed by this project. That's simply not accurate. First, let me note that Fish and Wildlife Service acknowledged that this project has a good amount of recent eagle use data that conforms with the Eagle Conservation Plan guidance. That data was used to populate Fish and Wildlife Service's collision risk model, and that's where that 2.5 number comes from. However, that number is high, and intentionally so. And it's high for a few reasons. One, it assumes 71 turbines will be constructed when as few as 52 may actually be constructed. And the collision risk model is actually based on data from golden eagle collisions with turbines. Golden eagles are more susceptible to collisions than bald eagles.
Why is that?
The manner in which they fly, according to the expert witnesses in this case, bald eagles are slightly more maneuverable than gold eagles and exhibit more avoidance than golden eagles. But even in terms of that 2.5 number, it's important to recognize that that is the 80% upper confidence rate from Fish and Wildlife Service. What that means is there's an 80% or greater chance that the number is actually lower than 2.5. And for this project, given the siting and where it is located outside of any migratory path, as Mr. Van Clay argues, this is south of any recognized globally important bird areas and in an area where there's only one eagle nest. And despite appellant's contention that a 2.5 mile buffer should apply to this project, that 2.5 distance has no scientific basis. Fish and Wildlife Service recommended distance was 1.18 miles. There's one nest in this project area, and that's 1.25 miles from any proposed turbine. And important to note as well, even with regard to the 1.18 distance, the Eagle Conservation Plan guidance does not prohibit construction of turbines within that distance. One more point on the migratory birds. The experts are in agreement, and they are in agreement, as Mr. Margard indicated, that there has been no study that has correlated pre-construction radar passage rates with post-construction mortality. In effect, pre-construction radar studies and the studies that supposedly are lacking in this case are not shown to be an indicator of risk. That's agreed upon by the parties. What is a good indicator of risk are the 200 mortality studies that were actually evaluated in this case that determine and inform that it's 2 to 4 birds per year per megawatt hour. If there's no further questions, I thank the justices for their time.
Thank you so much. Mr. Van Clay.
Let me start with Icebreaker first. There are 4 important distinctions between Icebreaker and Firelands. First of all, in Icebreaker, we had only 6 turbines. And the board found in that case, because there were so few turbines, that the risk to migrating birds was not all that great. Here we have more than 60 turbines. In Icebreaker, the board determined that the risk to birds flying over the water is less than the risk of birds flying over land. In this case, to one of the most important bird sanctuaries in the world. The third distinction is that in Icebreaker, we did have radar studies ordered by the board. They were to be conducted after certification and before construction, but at least the board ordered them in that case, even though the risk to birds in that case was much less than the risk to birds in this case. Secondly, with regard to the bald eagles, counsel is correct. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife estimation that 2.5 eagles would die per year is not accurate, because at the time that the Fish and Wildlife Service made that determination, it had not yet learned about 4 additional eagle nests located within 2 miles of the project area. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says that if the birds are within 2 miles of a turbine location, that those birds are at risk because they fly into those areas to feed and other activities. With regard to the grouting and the bedrock, council is right that a, quote, groundwater findings were made, but they're so generic that they don't apply here to the individual sites. Basically, their groundwater study said, we found groundwater in the area, and that's about the extent of it. Here we have individual sites that can damage the water wells located near those individual sites if they're not correctly studied in advance.
So are you saying the damage occurs from the grouting or from the placement of the turbines?
It results from grouting the openings to put in the foundations for the turbines. So they're located right at the turbine. And if a turbine is sited over a karst opening, and that karst opening is grouted, then if private water supplies in that area depend on water flowing through that karst opening, it will block their water supply and dry up their wells.
But again, it sounds to me like some of the grouting has been approved and other future grouting is going to require approval. So so is it correct that the grouting that's been approved is for turbines that have already been approved to be built?
I'm sorry. The board actually has disapproved grouting in the Castalia Bellevue karst plains. And it is said that if you're outside of the karst plain, then you can then the staff can approve grouting on a case-by-case basis. But it doesn't say that the staff has to employ any hydrogeologic data or have a hydrogeologist study that data.
But there's no pre-approval for grouting, right?
There is not, no.
Okay.
No, in fact, grouting was specifically disallowed by the board's opinion in that Castalia karst plains area, where the board found that due to the prevalence of karst, it was unsafe to grout those areas, and therefore those turbines could not be sited.
And not every site for a turbine is in karst, correct? Mm-hmm.
Correct. If it's outside of the karst plain, it could or it may not have karsts at the particular turbine locations. We know that there are some in outside of the karst plain. Some of the turbine locations are in the karst, but not all of them are.
But building a turbine not in karst, grouting is not an issue, right?
Well, if it's not in karst, it's not an issue.
Thank
no.
you.
However, the studies are lacking before the board to determine whether the individual turbines are in karst or not. There was some very limited geotechnical soil exploration done, But the expert testimony from our expert witness in the case established that that was not enough to determine whether there was a hydrogeologic risk at each one of those turbine sites. You can't do that just by looking at geotechnical data that determines whether a turbine will collapse into the karst opening.
But if it's not in karst, that's not an issue, right?
Right.
Thank you.
I think my time is over, Your Honor.
It is.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court. Thank you for being here today.